welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, delivering programs from radio's past. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Drama coming up in this hour. Later on, Parker Fennelly and Boris Karloff, starring an episode of From the Bookshelf of the World. But first, the Encore Theater, with the play Disputed Passage, a CBS broadcast from August 27, 1946.
Shenley Laboratories, producer of penicillin Shenley and Shenley Pharmaceuticals, presents the Encore Theater. The Encore Theater play tonight, Disputed Passage by Lloyd C. Douglas. Our stars are Dennis O'Keefe and Hume Cronin. Tonight, Shenley Laboratories presents another in a new series of great dramatic programs. Some of our stories are fact, the struggles and accomplishments of great men of medicine. Others are fiction, stories of devotion to an ideal, individual heroism, or great courage. By these programs, Shenley Laboratories would remind you that medical science and progress are not cold, impersonal research or pages of statistics, but a warm human story told in living terms. Whether it's the life of one of medicine's immortals or the everyday record of service rendered by your own physician. And listen at the close of this program for an announcement of the utmost importance about radio's newest program. And now, Disputed Passage, starring Hume Cronin as Tubby Forrester, Lorene Tuttle as Audrey, and Dennis O'Keefe as John Wesley Beavan, who tells us our story.
Walt Whitman once wrote, "Have you learned lessons only of those who admired you, and were tender with you, and stood aside for you? Have you not learned great lessons from those who braced themselves against you and disputed the passage with you?" Somehow that explains my relations with Dr. Milton Forrester, more commonly known as Tubby, far better than I am able to put into words. I chose that medical college just because he was teaching there. Not only was he an anatomist of distinction, but a recognized authority on neurological surgery. Hundreds of practicing physicians were proud to be able to say that they had studied anatomy under Forrester. But they also usually added that Tubby was a brute and a sarcastic bully and anything else that they could think of. No, Tubby wasn't easy, and he aimed his words like a knife thrower. I'll never forget that opening class in anatomy.
"Gentlemen, you will quickly classify yourselves into the categories where, by native gift and intention, you properly belong. Only a quarter of the class will turn out to be better than average students, better than average doctors. 10% of the class, the top 10%, will have much more to offer than diligence, concentration, and honest labors. They'll have self-discipline, and it'll be, for the most part, effortless and automatic. When the job becomes important enough to warrant your membership in the fortunate 10%, the outside distractions will not worry you. And once in a blue moon, the upper 10th delivers to medical science an explorer, a discoverer, a trailblazer. Is there anyone here who will tell us someday what we want to know about cancer? Will one of you someday give us a preventive for infantile paralysis? The two important gentlemen who are to perform these feats are, if I may venture the prediction, already born. They may be students in some medical school. They may be in this room now."
Everyone in the class sat motionless, transfixed, those words shivering down each individual spine. They were meant to kindle a fire, and they did. That was Tubby at his most inspirational. A moment or two later, I had a chance to see him at his most sarcastic.
"And now we'll call the roll. On this occasion, you'll stand when your name is spoken so that I may identify you. John Wesley Beavan." Kindly arise, John Wesley, wherever you are, and let the congregation see you.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. I observe by your registration form, John Wesley Beavan, that the first college you attended is a righteous little institution engaged chiefly in the manufacture and disbursement of preachers. Tell me, is it your belief, Mr. Beavan, that on the last day the trumpet shall sound and the dead shall be raised incorruptible?
Well, sir, it's a theory that hasn't been disproved yet.
When you write home to your pastor, tell him I'd like to discuss that with him sometime.
I don't think he'd be interested, sir.
What? Not interested in defending his beliefs?
Not interested in any discussion of theology that came from a professor of anatomy.
Ah. Thank you, Brother Beaver. Perhaps you'd do better if you stuck to your rhetoric. You may find anatomy difficult. We'll see. You may sit down now.
Sometimes he was biting, sometimes unbelievably courteous, sometimes he was angry, sometimes plaintive. Always he was a challenge. He liked to keep you fencing. He'd dart to any side of an argument just to see if you'd kept your wits about you. At Christmas, most of the students went home, but I had no place to go except my sister's, and she lived too far away. At 4 o'clock on Christmas Day, I was in the lab working over a drawing of some muscles when Tubby walked in.
Nice way for a pious young Christian to be spending Christmas Day. I should have thought you might be playing Santa Claus at some Sunday school festivity.
No one would have me. Not Tubby enough.
Hmm. May I venture to inquire what you think you're doing? We passed this drawing some days ago.
Yes, sir, I know. I was just curious about it.
Why?
Well, as far as I can see, the nerves in control of these non-functioning muscles are of the same structure and caliber of those of the frontalis. Why haven't they atrophied?
I see you're interested in nerves. Why?
Well, I couldn't explain, sir. They just interest me. Would you be good enough to tell me, sir, what I want to know about this one?
No, I won't tell you.
Pardon me.
I won't tell you because I don't know.
Well, then I suppose nobody knows.
Are you trying to say something smart, young man?
No, sir. I never was more honest in my life. I think that if you don't know, it's very unlikely that anybody else does.
Oh. You through with that thing for a while?
Well, I can stop, sir, if I...
I have to make a call. You might come along and have dinner with me, as long as you've got nothing better to do.
Well, thank you, sir. That's very kind of you. We spent the evening talking about science. He was as gruff as ever, but somehow that gruffness didn't fool me anymore. Underneath, there was gentleness and a sort of kindness. However, he wasn't gentle as far as I was concerned. He was merciless in his demands, and the way he found fault with everything I did, I was sure he had a little use for me. In class, we were always crossing sabers, and Tubby would goad me into an argument every chance he got. Now, I know I learned by those arguments. But at the time, they certainly rankled. And at last, after eternities filled with charts, examinations, microscopes, and lectures, we were ready for graduation. On the day after the mid-semester recess at a meeting of the senior class, Tubby got up to read the list of internships. He started by deploring the fact that the university hospital could not hold a very large number.
That concludes the list of interns. As for the special appointments, only two are being made this year. Mr. Thomas, whose work in Blood and Skin has shown great promise, will be invited to serve as student assistant to Dr. Meeker. And now, the other appointment. This, I think, may be somewhat in the nature of a surprise. If anyone ever tells you that these special appointments at the medical college are based upon personal favoritism or withheld because of private prejudice, this should end such thoughts forever. I am asking Brother Beavan to hold forth in my own laboratory through this coming year and serve as my private chaplain. All right. That's enough. All right. Do you accept, Brother Beavan?
Oh, I shall do my best, sir. I too believe that the ship is more than the crew.
You mean you don't have to like the captain in order to obey him?
That's what I mean, sir.
Gentlemen, this is a good example of the scientific spirit. That'll be all. You're at liberty.
Oh.
And so Tubby and I went to work, together. By the end of our third year of association, he not only had let me perform some of the operations for class observation, he had taken time off to lecture abroad and left me in charge of the class during his absence. Immediately after his return, he sent for me.
I understand your work's been adequate while I've been gone.
Thank you, sir.
We're getting a case from upstate tomorrow that promises to be interesting. It's referred to us by Dr. William Cunningham. Patient's a 5-year-old boy. My reason for calling you in on this case is because I've just had my lenses changed and I'm not quite accommodated to the correction.
Yes, sir.
The child's aunt is bringing him down. She's Chinese, I believe. Her name's Lan Ying.
Lan Ying. A lovely, fragile name that meant English orphan. I wondered what she was like, and since I had some instructions for her nephew, I phoned and asked her if I might come up for a moment. And so we met. In the hallway of the Livingstone Hotel. And there might have been a mountain in China, or any other of the world's most romantic places.
Hello, Dr. Bevan. Won't you come in?
I'll never forget how she looked that first day. She was dressed in a black oriental jacket and trousers. And her face was the face I had searched my dreams to find.
Sit down, Dr. Bevan. You aren't going to stand there staring at me all day, are you?
I beg your pardon, but, well, you see, I had heard you were Chinese.
By heredity and birth, I am completely American. My name is Audrey. But by environment and background, I am Chinese. I was born in Hong Kong, Doctor. My mother died in childbirth. I was taken in by a wealthy Chinese merchant and his family.
Your father?
They knew my father well. He died soon after my birth, and so Sen Ling and his family raised me as their own. Oh, I'm sorry. I've talked your head off.
Oh, no. Really, I'm very interested.
Oh, excuse me. Hello? Yes, he's here. Just a moment. It's for you, Dr. Bevan.
Oh, thanks. Hello? Yes. Yes? Yes, I understand it's an emergency. What's the temperature? Pulse? I'll be right there. Bye. I'm afraid that...
Yes, I heard.
Look, I want to hear some more about China, and I must talk to you about our patients, so... Well, how about having dinner with me tonight?
I'd love to.
I don't know what we ate. I don't know what we talked about. I couldn't tell you how we got to the dining room or when we decided to ride along the shore. All I remember is that her eyes were like no other eyes, and her hair was like no other hair. And she was like no other woman that had ever lived before or ever would again. And I remember that somewhere along the way, I stopped the car and kissed her. I suppose I should say I'm sorry, but I'm not.
Please don't. It would be very insulting, even if we never meet again. That kiss will be something very nice to remember.
I've never really gone with a girl. I guess I just haven't had much time for them. I never thought anything like this would happen to me.
Nothing has happened to you.
No, you're wrong, darling. You've happened.
Now, the second act of Disputed Passage, starring Dennis O'Keefe, Hume Cronin, and Loreen Tuttle.
I saw Audrey often through the months that followed. Either she came in for visits with Dr. Cunningham and his wife, or I went to visit them. For the first time in my life, I was enjoying every moment I was living. It must have been January when I got interested in the Buckley child. Dr. Forrester had operated on her, and she was recovering satisfactorily, except that her morale was bad. I did a little inquiring, and then I sent for her father.
Hi, Doc. How's tricks?
You Thomas Buckley?
That's me, in the flesh.
Sit down.
What do you want to see me about?
The nurses tell me that you're making Martha unhappy by sitting next to her bed most of the afternoon, criticizing everything that goes on in the hospital. Is that right?
It might be. I'll try not to let it happen again. Can I go now?
What do you live on, Buckley?
Well, my wife makes little potholders. I peddle them.
Mm-hmm. Where do you live?
Up at the edge of town. A few cheap little houses up there. Just this side of the reservoir.
Were you living there when Martha took sick?
Yeah.
What sort of a neighborhood is it? The ambulance got stuck in the mud, had to be hauled out. There was another case of polio brought in from that district yesterday.
No, Doc. Doc, that's not what ails the Collins girl. No, Doc, she'd had the flu and they were afraid of pneumonia. If they say she has infantile paralysis, they're crazy.
What's the matter with you, Buckley?
Nothing, Doc. Nothing.
Come on, Buckley, don't be evasive. You're withholding something, and I'm going to find out what it is before you leave here.
Okay, Doc. You don't have to get rough about it. But if you squeal, you'll wish you hadn't. Now, this is what happened. There wasn't any water in our houses, and the old hog who owned them wouldn't pipe it in. So this fellow Billis said we'd do our own plumbing.
You mean you tapped into a water main?
Yeah. It wasn't much of a trick.
Just your house and Billis?
No, four. Collins and another fellow did the digging, so we let them in on it, too.
Uh-huh. When you heard about the diagnosis of the Collins child, you began to make deductions. You think it's in the water. I suppose you tapped into the main between the reservoir and the filtration plant, right?
Yeah.
Well, the whole affair will have to be investigated promptly and thoroughly.
It can't be. There's more to it than that. This Billis fellow just got through serving a prison term, and he ain't going to be run in again without making somebody pay for it.
Well, I don't know that it's that serious.
Billis stole that pipe over in Wheaton. He had something on a fellow in Wheaton named Rusty who owned a truck, and he made him haul the pipe here. You start something that exposes Billis, and he'll squeal on Rusty. Then you and me will both be taken for a ride. You better tend to your own business, Doc.
But this is my business, Buckley. The result of this investigation could be of tremendous significance. Now, look, Buckley, come on. What do you say? Let's go have a steak and talk it over. I fed Buckley a steak, persuaded him that I would have to notify the health officer, and took him home. Then I went to meet Audrey. We sat in the hotel lobby talking, and my little universe rocked, and all the promises I had made myself about never falling in love dissolved and left me weak-kneed and about as coherent as a schoolboy.
You're unusually quiet tonight. You haven't said half a dozen words.
Oh, I've been thinking.
It must be something very serious, the way you've been scowling.
I've been trying to think of some very original way to say, Miss Hilton, I adore you. Will you marry me?
That's quite nice enough to accept, just as it is.
Oh, darling, you mean you would? Oh, no, you couldn't. You must be... Oh, but I'm not half good enough, but if you would, I...
Darling, of course I would, and I will. Thank you for asking.
Well, looking back on that night now, it still seems like a jigsaw with none of the pieces fitting. Right after I left Audrey, Tubby came to see her.
Yes?
I'm Dr. Forrester.
Oh, I've heard Dr. Bevan speak of you often. Come in.
I wanted to talk to you about Jack Bevan.
Of course. Won't you sit down?
Thank you. I'll come to the point immediately. I've come to you to appeal to you. I want you to give Bevan up. Oh. Ever since he's known you, his mind's been divided. His work's slipping. He's losing ground.
Oh, surely not.
You think he loves you? Perhaps he does. But he loved his career for a long time before he loved you.
I love him. I wouldn't interfere in his career. I'd be very proud of it.
Unless he's completely alone, he can't give his best to science.
But what you ask is impossible. Tonight I've promised to be his wife.
Well, I don't know how much you love him. But you seem to me the kind of girl who could never be happy knowing that she was keeping the man she loved from his best accomplishment.
There's no answer to that. There's no answer to that. Hello?
This is the hospital calling. Is Dr. Forrester there?
Just a moment.
Forrester speaking.
We just had a very strange telephone call from Wheaton, Dr. Forrester. A man called up and said that Dr. Bevan had been summoned out there on some pretext and had been in a fight.
A fight?
Yes.
Just a minute. Miss, give me a pencil and paper, quick.
Yeah.
All right, go ahead. Where is he?
In a deserted farmhouse about 7 miles west of here. Turn left at Larson's Dairy Farm. Your lights will show you where cars have turned around. Go in the back door. Is there anything we can do, sir?
No, nothing. But get a room ready and wait for further instructions.
I'm going with you.
No, you can't. I don't need you.
He may need me.
I can take care of him.
I'm sure you can. And I'm going to take care of you.
Tell me. What are you going to do about him?
Whatever you say, Dr. Forrester. Because you've admired and loved him even longer than I have.
Hold this flashlight on his face, please. That's right. Steady now.
Will you want hot water? I could try and find the stove.
No, I'm not doing anything now but a simple bandage. There's a very serious concussion here.
Will he? Is he going to die?
I hope not. Look, I'll have to drive down the road to telephone for an ambulance. Will you be afraid to stay here alone?
Yes. But I wouldn't do anything else. If he wakes up, is there anything I can do for him?
He won't wake up. Not until that pressure's lifted. And only then, if God's with us. I'll leave you the flashlight.
No, no. You'll never find your way back to the car.
I don't like to leave you here alone in the dark.
He's alone in the dark.
I'll get back as fast as I can.
Afterward, Audrey was never quite sure when it was that she first knew that someone else had come in that room. Perhaps it was the sound of breathing. Perhaps instinct. But suddenly she stood, a chill fear darting through her and her heart racing. At last she spoke.
Who's in this room?
It's me, Thomas Buckley.
What are you doing here?
I came back. Doc was good to me. He gave me a steak once. I didn't want to leave him to die.
Are you one of the men responsible for this?
No. It was Billis and Rusty. They brought me out here to get me out of the way so I couldn't testify against them. I got away about 5 miles down the road and telephoned Dr. Forrester. I've been all this time walking back.
Oh. When Dr. Beaven hears of this, he'll be glad to have had such a good friend.
The ambulance will be here in about 15 minutes. I have to operate as soon as I can get him to the hospital. All right. That's all. Wheel him out. That's the most that surgery can do for him.
Was the operation a success?
It was a surgical success. We won't know yet for several hours whether he'll pull out of it. I'll get you a room. You'd better get some sleep.
No, no, I'll wait with you. The sun is coming up.
Yes.
Oh. He's moving. Oh. Does that mean anything?
Yes. Yes, he's recovering consciousness.
Oh, Dr. Forrester.
Here. Let's not have you fainting now when everything's all right.
He will be all right.
Yes.
Then I will go, as I promised.
No, you're not to go. You're not to go, do you hear me? He needs you. He needs someone to work with him, to help him.
You really mean you want me to stay now? You don't want me to leave him, really?
My dear, forgive an old man a very human mistake. I thought he'd be better alone. But any man must be more inspired with a woman like you beside him.
Oh, Dr. Tubby Forrester, I love you. Very much.
Hey. Hey, what's going on? Close my eyes for a minute and I find you...
Darling. Oh, darling, how do you feel?
Oh, pretty good. What did you do, Tubby? Look inside my head to find out what was in it?
Something like that.
Thanks. Tubby, we haven't gotten along too well.
What do you mean? What do you mean we haven't gotten along too well? Fight better than any two people I've ever known. Man needs a good sparring partner.
Okay. I just wanted to say thanks for everything.
You're welcome. And now, if you'll excuse me, I'll get on down the hall. I've got some sick patients to look at. You're a convalescent now.
See you later.
And keep absolutely quiet. If you pull any of those stitches, I'll bash your head in.
Whatever you say, Doctor.
Somehow, I think this quarrel is over. I don't think you two are going to dispute the passage anymore.
He's a great man, Audrey, and a great doctor.
You're two of a kind, darling.
No, Audrey, you may be prejudiced, but I love you for it. Come here for a minute, will you? Kind of get into kissing range?
Whatever you say, Doctor.
In a moment, we'll bring Dennis O'Keefe back to this microphone, but first may we leave this thought with you. Unlike most of us, a doctor can never forget business completely. Even when your physician is enjoying an evening away from home, he has previously left word as to where he may be reached in case of emergency. Yes, doctors are on call any hour of the day or night, and they're noted for responding to that call always. Shenley Laboratories salutes in this series of programs the spirit of constant service to mankind which characterizes the medical profession. Now, here's the big announcement we told you about earlier in the program. Commencing next week at the same time, Shenley's Cresta Blanca Wines will bring you the most exciting new dramatic program to come from Hollywood in many years. It's the Hollywood Players Company, which consists of such top-flight stars as Claudette Colbert, Betty Davis, Joan Fontaine, John Garfield, Paulette Goddard, Gene Kelly, and Gregory Peck. One of these great stars each week in a great story which has been picked for your radio enjoyment. Tune in next Tuesday night for the grand premiere when Claudette Colbert, Betty Davis, Joan Fontaine, John Garfield, Paulette Goddard, Gene Kelly, and Gregory Peck will all be here to tell you about their own company, Cresta Blanca's Hollywood Players, radio's freshest dramatic idea in years. Betty Davis will have that outstanding English actor, Rex Harrison, who has just scored such an outstanding success in Anna and the King of Siam as her guest co-star in the Hollywood Players premiere program entitled The Small Servant. All the stars will be here next Tuesday night to tell you of their plans for the Hollywood Players' first season on the air. Don't miss it. And now, here is Dennis O'Keefe.
With this, the last broadcast of our present series for Penicillin Shenley, Shenley Laboratories extends its appreciation to those who made this program possible. The men whose lives reflect the spirit of devotion and service to mankind, which has been our dramatic theme. Once again tonight, Shenley Laboratories salutes America's men and women in white and proffers the hope that their dedication to the ideal of helping humanity may serve as a model for all of us who are now trying to build a better world.
Disputed Passage was produced and directed by Bill Lawrence and was presented through the courtesy of the author, Lloyd C. Douglas. It was a Gene Holloway adaptation. Dennis O'Keefe is now co-starring with Hedy Lamarr in the Hans Stromberg production, Dishonored Lady. Hume Cronin appeared through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, producers of the Technicolor musical Holiday in Mexico. This is Frank Graham speaking for Shenley Laboratories, producer of Penicillin Shenley, and inviting you to listen next Tuesday at the same time to the premiere broadcast of Cresta Blanca's new series, The Hollywood Players, radio's outstanding company of stars, inaugurating a season of great stars in great stories for your enjoyment. Next week, the first broadcast will star Betty Davis and Rex Harrison. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
The Encore Theater, on Tuned to Yesterday, an episode from August 27th, 1946, closing out their short-run series, which was heard in the summer of that year, producing 14 episodes for CBS, part of their Tuesday night lineup at 9:30. You're listening to an hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier. Now a broadcast of a series that has very few surviving episodes, called From the Bookshelf of the World. This Armed Forces Radio Service recording from 1949 features the vocal talents of Parker Fennelly, in actuality a younger man best known for his characterizations of the elderly alongside movie actor Boris Karloff, the play called On Borrowed Time.
Why is Aunt Demetria so mean, Grant?
Oh, born that way.
Why does she want to take me away from you, Grant?
Because it's about the only way she can get her fingers on the $15,000 that your dad left you, Pud. Some folks are funny that way. Well, you'd best go have your supper now, boy. while I finish this letter I'm trying to write you.
Who are you writing to?
The Reverend Murdoch. He looked pretty shabby when he was preaching that funeral sermon. I guess preaching don't pay what it used to.
What you writing him for?
I'm going to send him a check for $50. Now, that's a good deed, ain't it?
Oh, Gran, if you do a good deed, you can make a wish and it'll come true.
Yeah, that's so, boy.
That's what my book says.
Well, it must be so, then.
So make a wish, Gran. Make a wish.
All right, boy, soon as I think of a good one.
Grant, Grant, somebody's stealing the apples again.
Oh, darn it. I swear, I wish anybody who climbed that tree would have to stay up there till I let him down.
Grant, you made a wish.
Huh?
A wish. You wish anyone who climbed that tree would have to stay there till you let him down.
Yeah, a lot of good it'll do me.
Gee, I bet we catch one of those bad boys up there and we can keep him up there for 100 years. Maybe a million, huh, Grant?
Oh, hush. Hush, boy, hush.
What's the matter, Grant? You sick?
Nothing, boy, nothing. Just growing pains, I guess.
We all know that faith, if it is strong enough, can work a miracle. So perhaps because a little boy believed utterly in a wish coming true, it came true. Gramps, who always let the young thieves of his apples get away, no matter how much he shouted vengeance, found the next boy stuck in the tree, quite unable to get down, until Gramps, astonished, said the word. Could that be why he smiles now, as he sits on the porch with closed eyes at sunset a few days later? Or could he be devising some scheme to thwart Aunt Demetrius' efforts to take charge of Pud and the $15,000 he inherited? Growing pains, he'd told Pud. It was true. Gramps was growing old and very tired.
Good evening. Mr. Julian Northrop, I believe.
What's that? I didn't catch it.
Most people don't hear me the first time.
Well, how in blazes could I hear you if I was asleep?
Are you sure you were asleep?
Yeah. I guess I must have drowsed off. I felt kind of tired all of a sudden. Who are you? What do you want?
You. I request that you come with me.
Where are you going?
Where the woodbine twineth.
Where the wood... Well, I said that. I made it up. That's what you say to a child. I ain't no child. Hey, look here. Who in blazes are you?
You may call me Mr. Brink.
Well, look here, Mr. Brink. I don't like you. I don't like the way you snuck up here. I don't like the way you talk. And I wouldn't go with you to a rat fight. So now you know.
I'm afraid that is as it may be.
Oh, you are. Well, you better get out of here right away.
You see, it's time for you to come with me.
No. No, no, it ain't. I ain't going nowhere. I'm going to stay right here with Pud. So you get out of here. Go on now, get off my property.
Now, let's not be difficult about it. Your wife was so charming. She didn't fight me away. And this time, you can't.
No, no, I...
Come now.
No.
Come.
No, Pud.
You're being difficult. It's so easy and so pleasant. Now, don't worry. Look at it.
Just a minute, please, Mr. Brink. I think I'd like to have one last apple before I go.
All right.
You wouldn't like to get it for me, would you?
It's a curious request, but why not? Now, this one or this one?
Ones you can reach ain't so good as the ones higher up in the tree. They're the sweetest. So, you don't mind climbing, since it's my last request?
Very well. This high enough to suit you? If it is, I can fix it.
I don't want none of them. I got you up that tree, and now you're going to stay there till I tell you to come down.
And that's how it happened that Mr. Brink, who was deaf, became confined in the apple tree in Gramps' yard in Gainesville.
Gramps could see him and talk to him. And so, oddly enough, could Pud. But to everyone else, Mr. Brink was invisible. And his presence there was a secret. A secret, that is, until the day workmen came and started to erect a high fence around the tree. Not one to impede the progress of a secret, Aunt Demetria Whipple was also on hand. And before long, so was Dr. Evans, who soon heard the whole story.
Is this supposed to be a joke, Miss Whipple?
What would you say if I told you I believe it was the gospel truth?
I'm afraid I'd say you were crazy.
I would be crazy, wouldn't I? And what if I told you that Mr. Brink is a man just like you who goes around taking people away with him when it's time for them to die?
Die?
And not only that. Touching that tree is the only way anyone can die. There is no more death in the world, Doctor, until Julian lets Mr. Brink come down.
What in tarnation are you doing here, Dr. Evans? Oh, Dimitri.
Northrop, do you mean to say that there's somebody sitting up in that tree?
That's right.
And nobody in the world can die anymore?
Not until I say so. Unless they touch that tree, or one of them apples, or Mr. Brink himself.
You're not serious about this, Northrop.
Listen, I don't want you to go telling anybody about this. I got him up there. Now I've got to figure out what in tarnation I'm going to do with him. Mr. Brink!
Sir?
Notice he calls me sir.
You see, Doctor, you think someone's answering.
I'm sorry I ain't had more of a chance to talk with you. Her name's Demetria Ripple. You got anything on your schedule about when you're supposed to snuff her out?
Ripple? No such name has come to my attention yet.
Well, I'm going to keep you up there until it's time for you to exterminate her.
Are you going to be home later this evening, Northrop?
Yeah, of course I am.
I may be over and talk some more about this, Goodbye,
Doctor. I'm so too.
Goodbye, Evans. And listen, don't worry none about any of your patients dying for a while yet. Well, boy, back to work now.
Why don't I hear Mr. Brink, Graham?
I don't know, boy. I guess they're all too busy. Come in, sit down, Doc. You too, Dimitri, if you got to.
We haven't time for that, Julian.
As a matter of fact, Northrop, I've been telling a man I know about Mr. Brink and the tree.
Oh, now, what did you go and do that for?
Oh, what's the use? Try to get this straight, Julian, will you? Dr. Evans talked to Mr. Grimes, the head of the State Insane Asylum, and he's taking you there now.
You're taking me to the insane asylum?
It's just for observation, Northrop.
But there ain't nothing wrong with me, Doc.
Then we'll find that out.
Honest, there ain't nothing wrong with me.
Are you going along quiet, Julian, or does he have to put a straitjacket on you? He can. He's already certified you.
Well, sort of looks like I gotta go, don't it? Well, I'll just go up and say goodbye to Pod.
No.
You'll see him tomorrow. Miss Ripple will bring him up to the asylum. Better come along now, Northrop.
Sure. Yes, I'm going to go right along with you. I'm going to march right up to that bug house and surprise him. Oh, wait.
What's the matter?
My badge. I got to have my badge like I wear in parades. I'm a veteran, you know.
Fine. You couldn't march without your badge now, could you?
No, sirree. It's right here in the desk. I was afraid for a minute it was upstairs, but I got it. Now then.
Put that gun down. Put it down. This is no way of getting out of it.
It's the only way that occurs to me at the minute. Now listen, I ain't going to no bug house. And I ain't going to let this old she-cat have Pud. Now listen, Doc, I'll make a bargain with you. You take the worst poison you got in that bag and put some of it in a tumbler. Then you catch a fly and put him in the poison. If that fly dies, I'll give myself up to you, to the police, to anybody. Go to the insane asylum, do anything you say. I promise, cross my heart. Well?
It's the easiest way, Miss Ripple. All right, Northrop, okay.
You get the poison, I'll get the glass, and Dimitri, you catch a fly. You ought to enjoy that.
Oh, what?
Now, of course, a bet ain't a bet that don't cut both ways. If the fly lives, you got to swear I'm sane.
Oh, Doctor.
Don't worry, Miss Ripple. I know darn well I can kill a fly. If I can't, I'll quit medicine. All right, Northrop. Where's the fly, Dimitri?
Wait a minute. Here's one.
You got him?
Yeah. You got the poison?
Yeah. Enough to kill a horse.
Put it in the tumbler.
All right.
Don't get so excited, little fly. You'll be buzzing around just as good as new pretty soon. Now, in you go. There he is, Doc. Smack down in your horse poison. And you still think you can kill a fly, eh?
I've always thought I could, Northrop.
Well, you live and learn, Evans. You live and learn.
All right. He's been in there long enough. I'll get him out with these tweezers. And put him down on the table. There he is.
Looks kind of sick, don't he?
Sick? If I ever saw anything dead, I don't know what is.
He's dead, Northrop.
No, he ain't. Let me stir him a mite.
You see? You're crazy, that's all. Well, Dr. White.
It failed, Miss R. He'll come along with me now, I think. All right, Northrop. A bet's a bet.
Well, I'll be tarnation.
Well, let's get going. Put down that gun.
Yes, sir. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. He moved.
What?
Yes, sir. Look, he's drunk as a lord, but we didn't say nothing about that. Look, he's moving right across the table.
I'll be...
Dr. Evans, you didn't give him enough poison.
I gave him enough to kill a million flies.
Well, now will you believe what I've been telling you about Mr. Brink?
It seems I must, Northrop.
Where's the paper that says I'm crazy?
Right here.
Thanks, Doc. Now I guess you and Dimitri better go home, because I'm kind of tired.
James Evans, M.D.
Just read that last part again, Sheriff, where Dr. Evans signed.
All right, Northrop. Dr. James Evans, having testified that the said Julian Northrop is incapable of managing himself and his property, it's the order of this court that he be committed to the Gainesville Institution for the Insane according to the laws of this state. It's further ordered that the custody of the child be awarded to his aunt, Demetria Ripple.
And you fix me up good and proper, ain't you, Evans?
I warned you I'd do anything I could, Northrop.
I'll be good to the boy while you're in the asylum, Julian. Come, Pud. You're to come home with me now.
No. Grant. Grant.
Come along, Northrop.
I want to go with you, Grant.
You can't, boy. You've got your whole life ahead of you.
Don't want my whole life ahead of me. I want to go with you. I love you, Grant. Don't you love me anymore?
Oh, sure, boy. I'm just trying to make you understand it.
But I'll go with you, Grant.
You can't, boy, you can't.
Then I don't love you anymore. I don't love you anymore either.
Well, Julian?
Demi, you be good to him. You see that he gets some fun out of life.
Oh, I will.
Will you not be hugging and kissing him all the time like you do?
I have wonderful plans for him already. I'll start him in school next year. I'll teach him little poems to recite.
You'll do what?
Well, I'll teach him how to behave nicely. How to say yes, sir, and no, sir, and curtsy.
Oh, curtsy. You're going to make Pud into a sissy. Well, that settles it. I'm staying right here.
Northrop, you can't take care of Pud if you're in the asylum.
Oh. Well, Mr. Brink, looks kind of like the time has come.
Yes, Northrop, the time has come.
I hope you ain't going to hold anything against me. Remember, the only reason I got you up there was to keep Demi from getting the boy.
I've taken that into consideration.
I don't suppose, by any chance, you've had any word about taking her yet.
No. There's been no call for Miss Ripple.
What's that? You were supposed to take her an hour ago. Well, if you're supposed to take Demi, too, what? How about slipping the sheriff in for good measure?
Hey, what the devil is this?
No, it's murder.
What's that, Mr. Brink? You'll take the sheriff, too? Well, thank you. Come on, Demi. Sheriff, line up here. Give me your hands. Okay. Here we go. Off to glory.
Stop him, somebody. Stop him.
You can't do this, Northrop.
Hold on there, Northrop. We'll do anything you want us to.
All right. Mr. Brink, from now on, anybody who tries to make me let you come down, you've got to take them, too.
I will not. I will not.
Thank you very much. Now, get out of here, all of you. I'm going to stay right here and take care of Pud. I don't care if the whole world falls apart. So get out of here. Get off my property and stay off. Don't ever come back. Go on now. Beat it.
He was an old man, Gramps, and not well.
The challenging battle for his sanity had tired him. He slept late the next morning. So it came about that little Pud got up first and went out on the porch by himself in the early morning sunlight to wait for Gramps. And from the apple tree, Mr. Brink watched.
Pud.
Hello there, Mr. Brink.
Why, what's the matter, Pud?
Nothing. I'm waiting for my Gramps.
Why? Can't you do things by yourself?
Of course I can. I just don't want to.
Oh, that's because you're still a baby, Pud.
I ain't a baby. Don't you dare call me a baby. I'll spit in your eye.
You might find that rather difficult.
Why?
You couldn't reach me to do it.
I could, too.
Oh, you'd be afraid.
Who's afraid? Not.
That's not very polite.
It's politer than you are, you big squab of bush of puss.
I never heard that word before.
So what? Neither did I.
You can make up words.
Sure I can. I can do anything.
Oh, no, you can't. You can't even climb a tree.
I can, too. I climbed that tree before you got up it, and I climbed it down again. It's more than you can do.
You're right about that, but you couldn't do it now. Why, you can't even climb that fence.
I could do it with one hand.
Well, let's see you.
All right. All I've got to do is start from the rail here and reach over to the... Ouch! That hurts my hand.
Baby, I told you. Baby.
Who's a baby? Here I go. You just watch. Watch. Who said I couldn't climb this old fence? Look. I'm on top of it, sitting right up on top. Most as high as you.
That's right. I never thought you could do it. I guess you must be stronger than I thought. I guess you can do everything. Even stand up on the fence.
Sure I can. Watch me.
Easy. Come on now. Just a little more. Up. On the edge there. Get one leg over, then brace and up. There you are, Pud.
Yeah. Golly. I can see far up here.
Can you see me now?
Yes. Yeah. Gee, why do you make your voice so whispering, Mr. Brink?
Don't you like it?
Yes.
Ooh, can you see my face?
Yes, I can see your face.
Look at me, Pud. Right at me.
Gee. You've got funny eyes, Mr. Brink. They make me dizzy. You've got ghost eyes.
You're dizzy because you're high up, but I'll help you, Pud. Look at me again. That's right. Now I'm going to put out over.
Yeah, I am. I can't. I'm going to fall.
Down here, Pud. I'm just carrying you down the steps a little ways. Maybe far as the tree.
I don't want to go there. My back hurts. My back. I want tape on my back, Grant.
You got tape on it, Pud. Now, hush, boy. Hush just for a minute. Mr. Brink.
Yes?
Mr. Brink, Pud's in terrible pain. Dr. Evans just left. He says he'll never be able to walk again. Why did you let him do it, Mr. Brink?
My dear man, I didn't mean to hurt the boy. I just meant to take him. It was the only way out. I even waited a day to let the others force him. But you were too clever for them.
But you could have found some other way than to pick on the boy.
It's only through the boy that I have any hope of getting down from here. He's the only reason you won't let me come down. You yourself sentenced me to stay here until it was time for Miss Riffle to die. And already the world is beginning to feel the pain and sorrow and bewilderment in keeping me here. And it's getting worse every hour.
I guess I tried to bite off more than I could chew.
Much more.
Will you come down, please, and take us both?
Glad.
Well, please come then. Quickly.
Grant.
Yes, boy.
Take my back hurts so awful.
Yes, boy. Yeah, there, boy. Just a minute. Just a minute. There's help now. Mr. Brink's just going to touch
you. No, you're first, Mr. Northrop. So. That's better, isn't it?
Well, well. He was quite a lord before. He's light as a feather now. All right. Here he is. It's his turn.
Yes, he can stand up now. Put him down.
Well, say, look at that. As straight as you please.
Hello, Pud.
Hello, Mr. Brink.
Well, say.
Hello, Grant. Are we dead?
Must be. I feel like a 2-year-old. How do you feel?
I feel like a 2-year-old, too, Grant.
Mr. Brink, why didn't you tell me it was going to be like this?
My dear man, I've been trying to tell you how pleasant it is to go with me, but you wouldn't listen. Well, come along now. Come along.
Sure. Forward, march, Pud.
Sure, but where are we going, Grant?
What? Oh, yes, by golly, that is important. Where are we going, Mr. Brink?
Don't you remember? Where the woodbine twineth.
Oh, sure. How long will we be there?
For eternity.
How small is eternity, Grant?
Right smart piece of time, boy.
Anyway, we'll be there together, won't we, Grant?
You're darn right we will be. Yes, sir, you're darn right.
From the bookshelf of the world, on Tuned to Yesterday, an Armed Forces Radio Service recording from 1949, bringing the curtain down on this hour of drama on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from radio's past. And until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.